Welcome to the Plant Yourself Podcast. I'm your host, Howie Jacobson. Excited to let you know that you can now pre-order my new book, You Can Change Other People, The 4 Steps to Help Employees, Colleagues, Even Family Up Their Game. I wrote it with Peter Bregman, who is my coach teacher, my coaching mentor, and it's now available for pre-order. And when you pre-order, you get a whole bunch of fun, valuable bonuses, including 3 recorded demo conversations where we show you exactly how to go through the 4 steps with real people, and a 1-page cheat sheet so you can follow along. The book itself, when you pre-order, will arrive in your mailbox or inbox on September 22nd, 2021. Here's how to do it. Go to plantyourself.com/pre. That's just P-R-E, all lowercase. That will forward you to the page on the Bregman Partners website that has all the information about how to pre-order. Basically, you just order somewhere, either online or at your local independent bookshop, and you send us the receipt via email, and then you get your bonuses. So I'm really hoping that you will help me make this book a big success. I hope it will. You will find it very valuable, and that once you get it and read it, you'll use it and recommend it to others. And so if you've been listening to this podcast for a while and you have gotten value, this is a really easy way for you to give back. It would be a huge help. So again, that's plantyourself.com/pre, P-R-E, all lowercase. All right, let's get to today's show. So today's guest needs no introduction, so I'm not going to give her much of one. It is Miyoko Shinner of Miyoko's Creamery, Miyoko's Cheeses, Miyoko's all over natural food stores, Whole Foods, taking the world by storm with incredible plant-based cheeses. I wanted to talk to her about the journey of becoming this kind of entrepreneur, of playing in a very big arena, of having to deal with investors, with the pressures and needs and dynamics of venture capitalism, of having to source large amounts of product from all over the world, cashews from Vietnam, and how you maintain your vision, maintain your advocacy for compassion and a peaceful world amidst all the pressures to make a profit, to return to investors, to keep costs down, to, do all the things that one might have to do in business that might be a little bit uncomfortable for one for whom business is not a natural milieu. So we talked about her evolution. We talked about what Miyoko sees as kind of an ethical imperative to grow big in order to really give people another option, a choice, a viable option to replace dairy. So we can do all the, advocacy and preaching that we want, but if people aren't going to get something, just as good or better to spread on their bread and bake with and put on their pizza, people realistically aren't going to change. So it was a really interesting conversation. Miyoko is very clear-headed about why she's doing what she's doing, about the dangers of purity in any movement, and the importance of acknowledging the current reality, and that if we want to move to a more plant-based world, a more vegan world, a more compassionate world, we're going to have to acknowledge what exists right now and work within that framework, as opposed to being all pure and accomplishing nothing. So I hope you value this conversation. Without further ado, Miyoko Shinner, welcome back to the Plant Yourself Podcast.
Hi, Howie. How are you?
Great. I'm so happy to be talking to you again. You've been busy over the last several years since we talked.
I've had a few things going on, yeah.
I want to talk to you about the journey of building an ethical brand, of playing in the marketplace, of making decisions and having to weigh different options. But first, I'm just curious, what was the thinking when you decided, I guess you'd written Artisan Vegan Cheese in 2014?
2012.
Okay. You put everything into that book. Like there was no secrets. There was no, I'm going to withhold some stuff that, you know. And I know that partly because like a month after the book came out, you emailed everybody, hey, I've just figured out a better way to make the buffalo mozzarella. Right. And it's on my website. So use that instead of the other one. And so you're giving it all away.
Thank you for remembering that.
Yeah. Well, because I ended up writing it out in the back of the book and making a note like, no, not this one, that one. But, you know, so you're clearly like your goal in that book was just to give this to everybody.
Yes, absolutely. My goal in the book was to empower people to get in their kitchens and make something that wasn't commercially available back then. You know, this was, I mean, my plan was not to start a company. My plan was to arm people with the know-how to make their own cheese because vegan cheese was not readily available. I mean, the only things that were in the marketplace were the oil and starch variety, you know, made by a couple of companies that are still around. But, you know, I don't really consider that cheese in the true sense of the word, meaning a food that's made from milk, that's fermented, that has microbes in it and bacteria and enzymes and all this biological magic happens, which makes milk into cheese. And, you know, what was in the marketplace then, there were only about two brands, weren't really, in my opinion, they served a purpose, but it was more of a processed cheese alternative.
Mm-hmm, right.
And I wanted people to embrace the art of cheese making, of vegan cheese making in their own homes. You know, just as humankind had made dairy cheese for centuries, I wanted that magic to be shared with everybody. You know, so that's why I wrote the book.
Yeah, it's funny because there's so much about human culture, and you know, the word culture, of course, has multiple meanings. That you know, we grew up partly with animal agriculture, and there's so many, like I know people who are hunters who have a really strong ethos about how that makes them human. And, you know, in talking to Josh Lajani, who was a hunter, he's still pursuing that in terms of preserving wildlife and getting to know your environment. And it kind of reminds me of that sort of playing around with microbes and fermentation and creating these delicious products is a part of our human heritage that it'd be sad to lose.
Yeah, I completely agree. Now, I'm not sure I agree with the hunter, example of preserving wildlife. We could have a whole.
Yeah. No, I didn't mean that you preserve wildlife by hunting, but that.
Well, hunters do say that.
Right. No, what I'm saying is what people say they get from hunting is to be embedded in an environment, to know your environment, to be part of an ecosystem, and you can do that as a vegan.
You can do it even more so as a vegan because we're not taking away from anything, hopefully. So, and we're not depriving another being of the life that he or she wants to live. But yes, I agree. You know, I think we get very excited. You know, when we grew up, I assume you and I grew up watching the Jetsons, you know, on yep. TV or the Twilight Zone, or, you know, just imagining what life was going to be like sometime in the future when we were just going to be popping pills instead of sharing meals and things like that. But I mean, it's, you know, we are part of a culture. We're evolving as a culture, but to recognize from where we have come, you know, from the places that the origins from which we evolved, the continuum of all of that, and to really embrace it and to understand it and to take away learnings that are valuable and leave behind the ones that we need to reconsider and do better on. I think that's part of our human evolution. So the art of fermentation is beautiful. The fact that we learned how to make cheese out of milk over 2,000 years and really perfected that craft, we no longer need to have milk from an animal, but we did learn an art form. We did create an art form. And to be able to preserve that into the future and evolve it into, to give it new meaning, a new life form, I think it's a beautiful thing. And it's not something just to leave behind and say, well, we're not going to make cheese that way anymore. We're just going to do it in a laboratory with oil and starch. You know, to me, that leaves me feeling very cold. There's no story, there's no soul to that.
Which I'm guessing there's a way in which you really had to honor the traditional dairy cheesemaking tradition in order to transcend it.
I absolutely did. I had to study it. I mean, I read books, I watched videos, I even took classes in cheese making. Now, I was the only student who didn't partake in the sampling of the cheeses, but I really needed to understand the science. I really needed to understand the art, what was involved, and how was it different with plant milks. And I can tell you know, dairy milk, there's really only three milks that humankind's are making cheese out of. There's cow's milk, sheep's milk, and goat's milk. I mean, I assume you can make cheese out of, you know, mother's milk, human mother's milk, and buffalo, whatever. Well, buffalo milk as well too, but you know, elephant milk. But they haven't. It's the European culture that started cheese making, primarily out of cow's milk and the other two species. Well, three species, buffaloes as well. But plant milks, when you look at the plant kingdom, there are so many different kinds of plant milks. There are the kind that you find in the supermarket, and then there are so many more. You can make milk out of so many different kinds of legumes, seeds, nuts, grains, and every single one of them has a different nutrient profile. The proteins are different, the protein structure are different, you know, the peptides are different, the fatty acid profiles are different, the starch profile, all of it is so radically different. You can't expect it to behave exactly the same way as dairy milk. So, you know, a lot of people say, well, why'd you choose cashews? Well, you have to, it's just like getting, you have to get to know your milk. And so, as I played around in the very beginning with all these different plant milks, I realized that they all reacted differently to fermentation. Some didn't taste very good, some tasted great, some coagulated, some didn't. And I had to get to know at least one ingredient really well in order to be able to write a book. And so that, you know, that became cashews. And people say, well, can I just interchange them with something else? And you really can't, because it's just because they all act differently. I think I just kind of skipped around and went off topic there for a second, but
No, the topic is cheese and you, and
fluid. Yeah.
it's all in the it's all fluid until it coagulates,
That's right. That's exactly right.
right? So what was the impetus to say, okay, I'm going to start commercial production?
You know, to be perfectly honest, I've been an entrepreneur for the last, you know, really since my mid-20s when I went vegan. I've always had different businesses. And my goal at the time that I wrote the book was never to start another business. I felt like I wasn't good at it, and it was exhausting. And I still hadn't reconciled the idea of having a business, which is a profiteering enterprise, with my ethics, with, you know, trying to change the world. And I just didn't see how the two could jibe. And I struggled with that issue pretty much my whole life. And so I was determined never to have another business. But as I, you know, after I wrote the book and I went around the country doing cooking demos and speaking engagements, people kept saying, "Oh my God, it's an amazing book. I never thought I could do this. And I did it once and I never want to do it again. So can't you just start a company? And I'd rather just buy the cheese." So, and I just kept hearing it over and over and over again. And eventually I just thought, okay, you know, I really, really need to do this. The real impetus, I think, in the end, the thing that sort of, you know, really pushed me over the hurdle to where I felt like, okay, I can do this, was Seth Tibbett, the founder of Tofurky. You know Seth, right?
I don't.
You don't?
I
Okay.
don't.
Well, anyway, so, you know, Seth is one of the originals, and he's a legend in the industry. But he and I caught up with each other after not seeing each other or talking to each other for a long time. And he had some of the cheeses that I was making. He said, "Wow, if you decide to go back into business, I'll be an investor." And so that was really kind of what gave me the confidence, I think. enough people were saying, can't you just start another business? I'd rather buy the cheese. But it was really Seth that just sort of pushed me over the finish line to where I thought, okay, you know what? I do need to do this one more time.
So had you, as an entrepreneur, had you ever taken investment before?
Well, when I'd had my last business back in the 1990s, I had, but we're talking very small investments, like $5,000 from mm-hmm. a few people. So friends and family, not like this, this company. So mm-hmm. it's a whole different game. Back in the 1990s, I had a meat alternative company before meat alternatives were cool. When you're always trying to explain to people why you were making meat alternatives, Today you don't have to explain because everybody just wants to know what the latest and greatest is. But back then it was like, so why are you making this? Why don't you just eat chicken? That was kind of where it was back then. It was just a different time. I remember actually pitching to a room full of investors and people coming up to me afterwards saying, you are a great presenter. Your story is fantastic. I love the concept of your company. And in the middle of this dot-com, it was a dot-com boom, your food business just isn't relevant. I mean, no one actually said that to me. They all came up to me and told me what a great, pitch I had given, et cetera, but no one gave me any money. I mean, back then, all the money was going to dot-coms. This was in the mid 1990s, mid to late 1990s.
Right. Right. If you're not selling vaporware, nobody's interested.
No, that's exactly right. It was just a completely different world back then. Nobody was giving the time of day to an innovative vegan company that was trying to do something cutting edge. No one could see that there was even a problem. People didn't even understand then that meat was a problem, that milk was a problem. And so why, there was no problem to be solved. And so why give money to a vegan company? And so I just could not raise money. And so I'd gotten to a certain size with, the initial, whatever it was, $25,000, $50,000 or so I had raised from friends and family, plus a loan I got from, the city of San Francisco. But you get to a certain point in growth, you need more cash infusion to get to the next step. And I just couldn't raise any money. And I was exhausted. I just couldn't do it anymore. I was working night and day, and I didn't have a team. I mean, today I have, I've got a sales team and a marketing team and quality and human resources and R&D. We have all these different departments. Back then, I had an office manager and I had a bookkeeper and everything else was me. It was me, and then of course I had the production folks, but otherwise it was just me, myself and I doing sales, marketing, human resources, whatever it was. So.
Right. So when Seth comes to you and says, I'll invest, he's not talking about 5,000 or 10,000 and he's talking about putting his name up and helping you get like the money you need to build facilities and this team that you talked about. Was there any part of you that was like, I don't want to touch this?
No, I knew that when I thought about it, I realized that the idea had potential, but I couldn't do it alone. This is a very different time. When Seth was starting his business, when I was starting my business, and Seth started a decade and a half or so before I started my business in the 1990s. I think Seth started in the late 70s or so, maybe early 80s. Anyway, back then you could grow a company organically to some degree. It was getting harder in the late 90s, and it got harder even in the 2000s, to grow organically because the whole industry was changing. And as you know, when you were involved in Purple Carrot, now the time is completely different. People are expecting company growth to happen much faster. They're expecting market penetration at a much faster rate than ever before. There's so much more demand, and you have to be able to supply that that demand in a timely fashion, or they just switch to somebody else. And so, today it's very, very hard to just start a company, start small, and grow over the next 20 years. I mean, you can do that, but if you're trying to have market impact, and for companies such as ours, that these so-called disruptive companies, we're in it not just as a business, we're in it to have an impact on the world. We're in it because, as you know, Greta Thunberg says, or the IPCC report says, we don't have a whole lot of time left to fix things here on this planet. And so we have to overhaul the entire economy, the food system, everything. And so I realized that, and I realized that, you know, we had to grow relatively quickly and have as big of an impact as possible.
So, how did you deal with that concern you talked about earlier about profiteering versus ethics? Because, you know, at a small scale, it's a little problem,
Yes.
right? At a big scale, it's a big problem or a big opportunity. How did you talk to yourself, or how did you evolve, and where are you now?
Well, what I realized was that industry economy was one of the biggest ways businesses could impact change in a way that, you know, many other enterprises really simply couldn't, because people need food, people need access to solutions. And so if people are eating foods that are produced in a broken food system, if you can replace that, you're actually having a greater impact. So I could sit and preach all day long. I could go around the country like that with that Charlie Brown stand, you know, that says advice, for example. I could just go around the entire world with my little advice stand and a megaphone and talk about climate change and how everyone should go vegan. And then people would come up to me and say, but what am I going to do about the cheese? I'm addicted to cheese. And if there's no solutions for them, and even though I'd written a book, people still don't want to make the cheese, then I haven't won. We haven't won. The world hasn't won. And so, if we want the world to change, it's important for industry to lead the charge by providing solutions that make it easier for people to make the change. And therefore, I finally realized that if you had the right kind of business, it wasn't that business was evil. We all have to, I mean, there's just businesses everywhere. The business doesn't have to be just about profit. The pr true profit is winning together as a people. The true profit is saving the world. The true profit is all of us, all living creatures, finding peace. And I realized that business could help do that.
Okay. It's beautiful. So you then, how did you figure out like what the steps were? Like, I wouldn't know how to hire, like who to hire. I would probably get in trouble for having the wrong conversations. And I, like, you know, there's so many things I wouldn't know how to do to build a company. How did you navigate the early days?
Well, you know, I had a whole bunch of other little businesses in the past, so I had learned from them to some degree. And the other way you learn is you keep making mistakes, and you get to, you know, you think you know how to do something, so you do that little thing, and then you run into a wall and you make a mistake, and then you go, ah, I shouldn't have done it that way. I should have done it this way, and you rethink it, and then you do it better next time, and you just keep building on that. And I also got to a point where I realized that I needed coaching. I needed help. I got a CEO coach that helped me think through a lot of my problems. You know, I mean, even things like how to interview. How do you make sure that you're interviewing for the right, you know, God, I used to be so afraid of interviewing people for jobs because I wasn't sure, how do I do this right? How do I make sure I'm asking the right questions? And I read a bunch of books on how to do it. I think that really helped me. You know, every time I did it, I learned, oh, you know what? And well, actually, every time you run the company, you know, the more you run the company, you realize the things that are important. And then you learn to refine your questions. So you ask those questions. And you also learn to sell yourself and explain how to do that. So it's all a learning experience. You basically continue to make mistakes and you learn from your mistakes. You also surround yourself with people that are more knowledgeable in various areas. For example, I'm not an HR expert. Of course, when you're a business owner, you do have to learn almost every aspect of the business to a certain degree because you need to know whether or not someone is just, bullshitting you from another department, for example. And you have to be able to know that, the information, the knowledge that they bring from their field, that it's a cut above your own pay grade in that area. So you do have to know something about everything. And there's lots of books and tutorials and lots of help you can find. There are CEO mastermind groups. There's all kinds of organizations you can tap into as well. So you're really not completely lost, but every organization is different. And the things that are important to every organization also is can differ. And so you're never going to know all the answers that from the get-go. You just won't. You just won't. And no, nor will any expert who comes and joins you.
So one of the things you had to do to get the company started was convince people that it was probably going to be a success. Now, I remember tasting your cheese. I think we had an event at some downtown place in Portland at the Vita Vegan Con. I've had it at NAVS, the North American Vegetarian Society. So I was like, oh, of course that's going to be a success. And there's a lot of great ideas that don't pan out, and a lot of great foods and great entrepreneurs that for some reason or another just sputter and die or never take off. What were investors looking for? What was the evidence that was going to help them invest in confidence? Were you just like making cheese for people or doing surveys or market testing?
Yeah, I really didn't do any market testing. I really was just making cheese for people, and just telling my story. And I think it gave some people, the earlier investors, some confidence that I'd had experience before running a couple of other smaller companies. And so I knew the industry a little bit, that I had a track record of writing books. There was quite a following already, from writing the vegan cheese book. So I think that gave a degree of comfort. But honestly, I have to admit that the initial investors, which were mostly family and friends, plus Seth, and then that also led to a few other people. Seth introduced me to a couple of other folks that had invested. They were taking a chance. And to be honest, I wasn't as confident as I am today. Back then, I was really one of the reasons I didn't want to start another business was I didn't want to lose anyone's money because no one got a return on the investment in my previous company back in the night, the meat alternative company. We basically I sold the company just to get out of debt, so I sold it for the amount of the debt, and no one was ever repaid, and so I didn't want to make that mistake. I was so concerned that I was going to lose everyone's money. And that was another reason, that was the primary reason I was determined never to start a business. I just figured I didn't have that Midas touch to turn something into gold. So I was very, very afraid of that. My idea, and I discussed this with Seth, is that we were going to start small and just build kind of demand locally or among, passionate vegans, et cetera. And then we would take it step by step. We'd walk, crawl, and then walk, and then run. And unfortunately, I think we started out by crawling, and the idea was sell things online, and then we were going to open up, and the walking part was going to be proof of concept by having a little retail shop. And then the running was going to be going national. And we skipped the walking part. We went from crawling to running because within 3 months, Whole Foods and NorCal wanted the product. And then within a year, we were nationwide, in several thousand stores. So it just grew very, very quickly. And we outgrew the capacity for our production facility within a year and a half. And we were very, very strained there for 3 years trying to, we never filled all the orders. We were just constantly, running at about 70% fill rate, meaning about 30% of the orders were never being filled because we just couldn't.
How did Whole Foods find out about you and decide they wanted you in the stores?
Actually, I went to a consumer show. We went to a veg fest. That's what they're called. It's been so long. So we went to the Sonoma Veg Fest, and I was just selling cheese there. And a distributor came up, a local vegan distributor came up and said, "Wow, this is a great product, and I bet Whole Foods would be interested. So, would you be interested in presenting this to Whole Foods?" And I was like, "Yeah."
Gotcha.
Yeah.
All right. So you grew very rapidly. And what did you learn about cheese making as you were growing?
Yeah, so for a long time, the cheese making, what I realized about the cheese making was it was a very different thing, making small batches at my house. And then all of a sudden, we were going to these larger batches, which were they were still small. We were making 40-pound batches, and then it wasn't really well. Okay, let me backtrack. In Fairfax, in my small facility making 40-pound batches, I don't think I learned a whole lot because it was relatively similar to what was happening when I did it at my home. Where things really changed. Oh, actually, there was something interesting. I'm backtracking. Okay, so it turns out we had an aging room. So our cheeses were aged just like dairy cheese. So we had an aging room, and it was a rudimentary aging room. I didn't have the money to put in a fully stainless steel aging room. So we had galvanized steel in there. Galvanized isn't supposed to rust. Well, after several months of this aging room being full of cheese, we noticed this white powder being formed on the galvanized. And then we brushed off the white powder and noticed that it was rusting. And I talked to the installer, the refrigeration specialist, and what was going on. They're like, "I don't know, I've never seen this before." And I started Googling it and couldn't find anything. And I finally realized, I can't remember what it was. I was like, "What is this white powder? What can form this white powder?" And it turned out it was acetic acid. So basically, it turns out when you ferment vast amounts of cashews, and who would know this because no one has ever fermented vast amounts of cashews, it actually emits acetic acid into the air. So vinegar into the air, which caused the corrosion of the galvanized steel. So this is probably the first time in the 2,000-year history of recorded cheese making that anyone had ever seen something like this before, because no one had ever done it before. So that was really interesting. And then when we moved into this new facility, we built a new facility in 2017, moved in here at the end of 2017. And this is a big facility with large pieces of equipment. We're making batch sizes now of, you can hear water being lapped up in the background. That's my dog drinking water. But anyway, we went to making 1,000 kilogram batches from 40 pound kilogram batches. We found more interesting things happened. And for a while, with the equipment that we had installed, the cheeses never coagulated. So we were using the same method we had at 40 pounds, but the cheese stopped coagulating. Now, I can't tell you the science behind it right now because I'd be giving away some trade secrets at this point. I'm no longer publishing these books on mass manufacturing, only on how you make it at home. But basically, we had to change our processes to create coagulation. We had to learn how to recoagulate these cheeses.
Gotcha. You mentioned you've got trade secrets now. You also have a lot of competitors.
Yes.
Virtually all your competitors pay homage to you. They all started with your book. What's your feeling about the vegan cheese landscape?
Well, you know what? I like to say that my book was the one that it's the book that launched 1,000 cheese companies. And it brings me great pride. Now, I really do. I'm happy. You know, I visited a vegan cheese shop in Hungary, in Budapest, and I walked in and the woman, the proprietor, it was a tiny little hole in the wall shop. And the proprietor came out and she just gasped and she goes, "Oh my God." She was so thrilled. You know, I visited a little cheesemonger in London. Same thing happened. Let's see, I met a young lady in Singapore making vegan cheese, had also learned from my book. Honestly, it's flattering, but I wrote the book so people could be empowered. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't write the book so people wouldn't make cheese. I mean, you know, that's, it's just like dairy cheese. Dairy cheese, I mean, who owns the trade secrets of dairy cheese? Companies have their own proprietary secrets for a particular cheese, but the whole idea of fermenting milk and turning it, coagulating it and aging it and brining it, that is a well-known science. People go to school for that. And I'm hoping at some point people will go to school to learn the art of vegan cheesemaking and then put their own personal spin on it. We can't overtake animal dairy unless we can completely sub out all the products there are. And it's not just up to my company to do that. We need many different companies making many different kinds of cheeses. I mean, the goal isn't for my company to succeed. Of course, I want my company to succeed. Of course, I want to be the premier leading cheese company in the world. But I want many others to join the fold because that's how we win together.
Love it. Yes. Oh, so I've been following, you know, your Facebook posts over the years, and they get a lot of commentary, and they're very often tackling challenging topics. And one of the things is, like, you are known for being sort of very pure in your advocacy. And now all of a sudden you kind of have to balance the purity of veganism with business concerns, with who's investing in companies that are supplying you, what are the conditions among the cashew workers? How do you navigate what now has come to be, you know, you're a very public figure. Like, I was thinking about this morning, in terms of name recognition, you're by far the most name recognized person I've ever talked to on this podcast, because you named a company after yourself. How do you navigate public expectations and projections onto you?
Well, I think we have to all remember that we're all human. I don't know. I mean, there's no such thing as being other than being a pure human, meaning I am human. I think purity is perhaps overrated. I think one of the dangers is when people start to idolize or have these idealized perceptions of people. That's when they're setting themselves up for the greatest disappointment, when the person that they perceive to be absolutely faultless or infallible or pure does something that somehow jars the ethics of the perceiver. That is definitely happening to me a lot more because we don't live in a pure world. I'm not an angel. I'm not a saint. I'm a human being trying to figure out the best way to do things in an imperfect world where everything isn't black and white, especially right now. We're navigating through gray waters, through turbulent gray waters, stormy waters, trying to quell the violence and the horror that's surrounding animals and this planet. And to get from here to the promised land is going to be rough seas. And, you know, things aren't black and white. We're not going from a world of animal agriculture overnight to a vegan world. We're going to have to navigate the infrastructure that exists today, which is wrought with animal ag and, exploitation of every single kind. So we have to figure out what's going to have the biggest impact, what's got the least harm, et cetera. It's about doing the best. It's not about perfection. So at Miyoko's, we've done everything we can. And I'm not saying we do it perfectly, but we do everything we can to vet our supply chain, to make sure that we are, ensuring the highest standards of practice for worker treatment, environmental protection, et cetera, for all the ingredients that we source. We have, we try to maintain the best practices here as well at Miyoko's. And even with investors, I try to make sure, for example, our most recent Series C was led by Power Plant Ventures, which is a VC that invests only in plant-based businesses. Mm. We didn't, I don't want to say we didn't take blood money. We'll put it that way. Mm. We could have, I guess, but we didn't. And I wouldn't even call it blood money because, if you remember when Beyond Meat took money from Tyson, and a lot of people were really irate with Beyond Meat about that. But Tyson expressed an interest in the alt protein landscape. And the CEO at the time even made a comment saying, well, I don't know if the future could mean that protein will come more from plants and from animals. And so they realized that Beyond Meat was on a path to really setting the landscape for the future of protein, and they wanted to take a part in that. A lot of these corporations, it's not like they're committed to torturing pigs or animals. They're just in it for the money, and they'll follow the money. If the money is alt protein, they're going to go down there eventually.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something that I think, a lot of times vegans are our own worst enemies because they're not looking at it with a long lens. They're looking at it very, very myopically at like what's happening right now. This is an evil corporation. Don't let them touch you. And the fact is, we're not in a vegan world right now, and there's going to be some mixing of companies. We can't operate in a completely pure fashion. But for example, we have a co-manufacturer that makes some of our products for us, and we started this relationship last year. That co-manufacturer, they're doing so well with our products. They're devoting more and more of their production time and space and building new space that's going to be exclusive just to us, mm-hmm. even though they're a dairy manufacturer.
Uh-huh.
So to me, that's a good thing because maybe eventually they'll become plant-based entirely. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's a I can hear it feel in my own psychology. The part of me is like, well, people need to be better. And so my activism, I'm going to try to get people to be better. But realistically, that's a really, you're not going to make a big change if you're relying on people to be better. People will make a change when your cheese tastes better and is cheaper than regular cheese, not because it's more environmentally friendly or less cruel. Companies are going to invest in plant-based alternatives because it makes them money, not because they suddenly have become a board of saints.
Yes. I mean, yes, I agree with you. And at the same time, I am a very, very hopeful person. And I am betting on the continued evolution of humankind towards being humane. I really, truly believe that humankind can evolve and become better. I think we're already better than we were 200 years ago when we enslaved our own species. Go back to the golden age of Greece when half the population consisted of slaves. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't the first democracy. So humans have evolved. We have gotten better. And I do believe that humans can continue to get better. I'm not giving up on that. And I will continue to talk about the ethics, not just push flavor, because I believe that we do have to make improvements in our own human condition.
Right. Well, I found that it's much easier to talk to someone who's gone plant-based for their health to talk to them about environment and animal welfare than while they're still eating meat and drinking dairy. Like
Yes.
once they've taken the hedonistic step,
Right.
right,
That's
then
exactly right.
it's much easier for them to be in alignment with their identity to say, oh, well, maybe I can look into these other things because I'm not my coherence isn't threatened anymore.
That's exactly right. Yeah. I mean, individuals are self-centered and they have to do what feels good for them initially. And then and only then can they actually start thinking about other things outside of themselves.
So one of the things I'm hearing is sort of a theme in your approach to life is you don't know and you're going to try things and find out,
That's
right?
exactly right. I don't have the answers.
Like I heard that in terms of how you create your recipes, how you create your processes, how you start a company, how you navigate the world. That's, when you talk about vegans being their worst enemies, like with any sort of passionate group, there can be a dogma that coagulates
Yes.
around I am right and they are wrong. And I hear very clearly that there's areas where you believe that your ethics are correct and should be widely adopted. And there's also a lot of areas where you're extremely humble.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot I don't know. I mean, the one thing I am certain of, and I guess there's a humility to that, there's also a pride to that, is that I think the only thing I'm certain of is that love and compassion are what matters in the world, and everything else is secondary. And so you have to look at life through that lens. It doesn't matter if you win just because your opinion is right. I have this conversation with someone in my family all the time, but ultimately, if being right means you drive people away, if being right means that you end up alone in the world, if being right leads to a sense of anger and that self-righteousness and pride, then it's probably not the right. You're probably not right. Because there's no being right is a giving, means that you have a flowing over an overabundance of love that flows outward. It's a caring. Being right is about caring. It's not about self-protection. It's not about winning an argument. It's not about winning an argument against somebody. It's about winning together. And if we can't win together, then maybe you might want to question your sense of righteousness.
So I'm curious whether, you talked about your evolution around business, that it can be a force for good. And there's so much sort of about our capitalist system that kind of argues against the idea that love and compassion are the driving factors. I'm wondering, as you're on your journey, have you had to change sort of business as usual in any way so that love and compassion can trump profit and growth?
Yeah, it's so love and compassion, of course, plays out in different ways at times. It doesn't mean, sometimes I've had hard situations here at Miyoko's. For example, when a company grows as fast as we have grown, sometimes you have to change your team and you have to let people go. And some people don't feel that's a very compassionate thing. There's another way to look at it. If those people are struggling to keep up at work, letting them stay there isn't very compassionate either because they're not very happy. I remember the very first time I had to let somebody go who had been with me since the beginning. I had four employees in the beginning. And this person was with me for, gosh, 3.5, 4 years. And this person wasn't able to keep up anymore. I mean, the person was no longer, what this person had been doing. Well, he just wasn't able to perform. And when I let him go, he said, "I was wondering when you're going to let me go." And he realized himself that we were just at a different level. But he wasn't going to quit. And so, but he wasn't happy. You could see that he wasn't happy. So, you know, in some ways you could say, well, why did you let an original person go? But on the other hand, you know, he's probably much happier today, because we all have to find our perfect spot in the world, wherever that is. But in terms of like my own business, I've made a conscientious effort to create a culture that benefits people. And I'm not saying everyone is happy. There are people that are always going to complain and be unhappy. And then there are many that, you know, come to me. I had somebody come to me yesterday and say, I just want to thank you for starting this company. I finally have a place I love working. But, you know, for example, we have a lunch program, we have a meal program. So even though we're not Google, you know, we feed our entire staff. There's always food. There's a hub. We chose this particular location because it had this beautiful courtyard, because I wanted a place where people, employees could enjoy their work environment rather than just reporting to work. I find it really depressing when, you know, you're caught inside somewhere and then you have to go out eat in the parking lot or something. And you can't, you know. So even though we're not Google or, you know, Dropbox, and we don't have a big fancy building, you know, we wanted someplace that was really enjoyable for what we have here. We have, I think, you know, we're a B Corp, and so we try to abide by all of their standards. We, you know, living wages, we have a robust benefits program, PTO, all of that stuff, which oftentimes, you know, you don't find with smaller food companies or startups.
And can I just connect that to the fact that a wheel of your cheese can cost $9 in the supermarket?
Yes.
Like, it's so easy for me to just get angry at prices, especially if I've, you know, entrained onto a different price. But to think for people to think about where the money is going, and when it's cheaper, where the money doesn't go.
Yeah. And, you know, I want people to know we're not profitable. We're still not profitable. So, I guess, you know, if I paid everyone minimum wage and didn't provide any benefits, we probably could have been profitable by now, but I don't think that's the way to do it. Mm-hmm. We've also checked our supply chain. You know, I went to Vietnam and visited the cashew processing facility to make sure that their workers were treated well and were safe, and was very happy with what I found there, read their third party audit. You know, there's a lot we've done to assure that we're not always paying the cheapest price for our supply chain, because we're making sure that we're getting not just quality ingredients, but we're buying from a quality company that's taking care of their employees, et cetera. We also have to remind you that the reason, you know, our cheese wheel that's $9 is $9 because we don't get government subsidies from, you know, that like the dairy industry does. And if the dairy industry were to lose their subsidies, I don't know how much a block of cheese would cost. But, you know, we're also with scale, we have introduced products that are a lower price point, and we will continue to innovate and produce products that are going to be more competitively priced with our animal dairy counterparts.
Speaking of innovation, how much time do you get to play in the kitchen these days to create cheese?
Very little. I do head up the R&D department. So I do work with them, and a lot of the products that we're working on were, so we have like a cottage cheese that's rolling out that has about 10 grams of protein per serving. And it's with a very, very novel plant milk. It's fully organic, really clean ingredients, and there's no added oils or anything. While I didn't, the way that started was me playing around the kitchen with different plant milks and doing different things and finding a way to curdle this one plant milk to make curds. Uh-huh. After I figured that out, I brought it in to the R&D lab and said, look at the curds that I got. They're like cottage cheese now. I want you guys to make cottage cheese out of this. So I still contribute to a lot of ideas. I still contribute to some of the initial processes that spur the development of a product, but I don't have the bench time available to be, innovating every single day for 8 hours a day. I mean, that's what it takes.
Do you want to? Would you love to like fire yourself as CEO and just go back to the kitchen and hire a CEO, or do you like the role you're in?
I like the role I'm in. I'm still able to innovate. I still play around with stuff. For example, I took the cottage cheese home recently, and I thought, "Huh, if I brine this, I could make feta crumbles out of it." And so I did that, and then I brought it into R&D and said, "Look, I got something that's like feta. Now make it better." And then I took some more curds home, and I grew. Started growing some blue mold in it in my refrigerator, for example, to make blue cheese. So I'm still playing around in the initial phase, but then, but I get to do a lot more stuff. I get to do podcasts with you, for example, or I get to do cooking shows. I get to do more marketing. I mean, I'm able to use my creativity in other ways as well. And so I think, overall, I like what I'm doing, being more of the visionary that leads the company forward. If I were only on the bench, I would be product focused. I think that's one of the mistakes that a lot of entrepreneurs make. They think that the product is the company. The product is not the company. You have to have a great product. But the company is how you communicate that, the vision, the marketing, it's everything else. That it's also the company itself, the culture. That's also important. It's all the people that you hire that are going to help you take it to the next level. And so, just being stuck in R&D, I would have to hire somebody else to be the visionary to lead the company forward. And I don't want to do that. I want to be the visionary.
Gotcha. So are you happy that you named the company after yourself?
I am, and that was after hiring. We actually hired a naming specialist who gave us something like 300 names, and we went through all of them, and finally it was like, just gonna call it Miyoko's Kitchen. And now it's just Miyoko's, but
So what have the advantages? I imagine there, I don't know, there may be some downsides to that as well, but what have
I
you
think the
seen?
downside is for a long time people kept calling it Mykonos. Oh, that's the Greek company. So that's one downside. people ought to be able to pronounce it. Is it Myokas? But then again, you think about brands like Chobani or some of these others that have sort of interesting names as well too. And you realize, you know what? Consumers can learn. I think yeah.
What about, I mean, for you personally, to like it's it would be very different if you were the CEO of Miyoko's, that like in insider industry insiders knew about, versus you can get people to drop their jaws in a in European cheese shops.
Yeah, well, I think I think people like having a face associated with a brand. If you think about Bob's Red Mill, for example, Bob is real, and at Expo West, he leads a marching band down the aisles. I don't know if you've ever seen him,
No.
but people get he's a hoot. People get a thrill out of the fact that there is a real guy named Bob, and he gave his company away in the end to all his employees, I believe. So, people love that sort of story, or Ben and Jerry's or whatever. People love the fact that there's actually a person behind a brand. And I think that's been one of the reasons for the success of our company. If I'd called it, I think initially I had a, I wanted to, what was it? It was like, it wasn't Blue Dog. What, I can't remember. But I was going to call it something dog. I have, two dogs at the time, and I don't remember what it was. I don't know, Fun Dog Creamery or something like that. And no one would have known. I don't know if it would have gotten to where it is today had I not called it this.
Yeah, I'm imagining it also can really focuses you on the ethics, right? That this is a representation of you. It's
Yes, yes.
more than it would be if it was just the company you
That's right.
started.
Yeah, I mean, I think people want to know that there's a real person, that there's there is a real vision. There's real meaning behind a brand rather than just, it's just another corporation just doing whatever and who knows who's running it, you know? So I think there's a degree of comfort. And also I've tried to make myself more accessible, which can be a problem sometimes. But, you know, I really do like connecting with people. I mean, that's why I did this cooking show and, you know, this, and it was Facebook Live because I actually liked interacting with comments live because I don't know, it makes me feel more connected. Like I find it harder to just record something when I don't have an audience. I like being connected with an audience. It keeps it real.
Well, your presentations at the Veg Fest have always been, you know, hugely fun.
Thank you.
So, last minute, you're doing work with sanctuaries?
Yeah, I have a sanctuary, a farmed animal sanctuary, or I started a 501c3 nonprofit. My daughter is the my youngest daughter is the sanctuary manager, and we have another employee and volunteers, and we also support other sanctuaries. So at Miyoko's, we donate to other sanctuaries as well. Not all of them, obviously. There are so many, but you know, we try to support as many as we can. I really do believe that sanctuaries are a wonderful way to connect people's hearts to the lives of animals and help them really think about the ethics of animal agriculture. So I'm a big proponent of sanctuaries.
Gotcha. Is yours open to the public?
It is.
Where is it?
It's in West Marin. It's in a little town called Nicasio, about 45 minutes north of San Francisco.
Well, it's been so lovely to catch up with you, to hear your thoughts and to celebrate your evolution and your journey and the huge impact you've had on so many people's lives. So I'm really happy and honored to have had this hour with you.
Well, thank you. It's been great connecting with you again.
All right. Well, may you go from strength to strength.
All right, you too.
All right. Show notes for today's episode, plantyourself.com/481. You can click through and order cheese. You can get Miyoko's cookbooks and immerse yourself in the world of artisan vegan culinary exploits that is Miyoko's world. So let's see what's going on. My wife came back from the farm store today with a pound of kale seeds. Do you know how little kale seeds are? A pound of them. There must be, I don't know, 3,000 or 4,000 of them. So we're clearing. I spent a lot of time. We both did over the weekend clearing beds, pulling up weeds. We kind of let the ground go fallow a little bit. We had what's called in the Torah a Shemitah year, a year in which we let the land rest. Mostly, we let ourselves rest, and the land followed suit. But now we're getting ready for fall planting, pulling up a lot of things that are going to, you know, get really hard to pull out if we don't pull them out soon, like Sweet Annie, lamb's quarter. They're both wonderful plants. Sweet Annie makes great aromatic wreaths, and lamb's quarter, the leaves, they don't taste very good, but they're incredibly nutritious. And so we're pulling out a bunch of those to make room for annuals, and we're also leaving enough of them in that we still have a supply. Movement news. A lot of the movement was in really, really hot weather, doing very strenuous weeding, hoeing, carting. Also managed to play some ultimate on Saturday, and yesterday, this morning, actually, I ran 6 miles slowly, but again without pain. So all's good on that front. All right, time for thanks. Thanks to Will Ridenour for allowing me to use his beautiful song Sabali Dawn, the Dance of Peace. You can find more of Will's music at his website, willridenour.com. And of course, thanks to all of you Plant Yourself Podcast patrons. Kim Harrison, Lynn McClellan, Brittany Porter, Dominic Maurer, Barbara Whitney, Tammy Black, Amy Good, Amanda Hatherley, Mary Jane Wheeler, Ellen Kennelly, Melissa Cobb, Rachel Behrens, Tina Scharf, Tina Ahern, Jen Filikanovsky, David Bizek, The Mysterious Michelle X, Elsbeth Feldman, Leah Stoller, Alan Christensen, Colleen Peck, Michelle Landry, Josina, Sarah Durkas, Kelly Cameron, Janet Selby, Claire Adams, Tom Franzek, Jeanette Benham, Gila Sert, David Donahue, Blair Seiberg, Dorona Vizov, Gio and Carolyn Argentati, Jody Friesner, Misha Rosen, Michael Warbeck, Aviva Lael, Alicia Lemus, Val Linneman, Nick Harper, Banda Nachali, Molly Levine, The Inscrutable Harry R., Susan Laverty, The Panda Vegan, Craig Kovic, Adam Scharf, Karen Burry, Heather Morgan, Nigel Davies, Marion Blum, Teresa Koppel, Julian Watkins, Breed O'Connell, Sharon Hirschman, Linda Ayad, Holm Hedegaard, Iza Tuzinwa, Connie Hainline, Aaron Greer, Alicia Davis, Heather O'Connor, Carolyn Jensen, Sherry Olakoski of Plant Powered for Health, Karen Smith, Scott Marani, Karen and Joe Crabtree, Kirby Burton, Teresa Carell, Kevin McCauley, Elizabeth Rothschild, Ann Jesse, Cheryl Dwyer, Jenny Hazelton, Peter W. Evans, Dennis Bird, Darby Kelly, Lori Fanny, Linnea Lundquist, Emily Iconelli, Levy Wallach, Rosamund McAtee, Dan Picorni, Stephen Leenan, Patty V. Martino, Mike and Donna Kartz, Deanne Bishop, Bilberry Elf, Marjorie Lewis, Trisha Adams, Nancy Sheldon, Lindsay Bayshore, Gunmarit Hagen, Tracy Gullidge, Laura Heaton, Meg from Mama Says, Stacey Stokes, Ben Savage, Michael Kay, David Hughes, Connie Rogers, Claire England, Sally Robertson, Paranganchi, Amy Daly, Brian Tourville, Mark Jeffrey Johnson, Josie Dempsey, Karen Schmidt, Pamela Hayden, Emily Perryman, Allison Corbett, Richard Stone, Lauren Vaught of Edible Musings, Aaron Hasty, Sean Owen, Sagar Nayak, Erica Piedra, Danielle Roberts, Michael Lushton, Sarah Johnson, Catherine Floyd, for your generous support of the podcast. That's it for now. As always, be well, my friends.